Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, happy Monday, everybody, and thank you so much for tuning in to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, which, of course, as always, you can find on iTunes if you ever miss the show live under Get Yourself the Job. Today, we're here to explore a very interesting topic about health and work-life balance with Lee Stringer. Lee is a senior workplace expert for EYP Architecture and Engineering and is researching employee health and productivity in conjunction with the Harvard School of Public Health, the Center for Active Design, and other leading organizations. Lee currently lives in Washington, D.C., and today we're going to be talking about her new book, The Healthy Workplace. So, Lee, tell our listeners, first, thank you for being here, of course. Thank you so much for joining us from D.C. And tell our listeners a little bit about your story. From what I understand, you started off as an architect, and then you became interested in the workplace. How did that come to be?
Well, thank you for having me, first off. Yes, I am an architect by training. I went to school in St. Louis and marched off into the workplace, working for lots of different organizations, designing museums and mostly architecture firms, I should say, and designing buildings of all types, and in corporate office buildings and government facilities and all kinds of things. And at a certain point, pretty early in my career, I realized I loved the business side of design, really getting to know the occupants of the building, how they work now, how they might want to work in the future, how they behave in space, and how that space really informs the way that our emotions and our movements and all kinds of things. And then I decided I would just take a little career shift and started specializing in workplace strategy and research. And that's what I do now. And The Healthy Workplace, my latest book, is really just an extension of a real curiosity about what makes us tick and how space can benefit us, as well as lots of other good habits to work better and work smarter.
Interesting. So you started off as an architect and you were obviously great at design and you appreciated the business side of it, and then you wanted to apply it and got kind of interested in the, almost I want to call it like anatomy of what a healthy workplace looks like, right?
Yeah, it's a lot of psychology, behavioral, you know, organizational design and behavior. I feel like a lot of times when I'm meeting with clients, I should just have a psychologist couch right next to me. Talk people off a ledge sometimes, because the workplace can be stressful, can be dynamic, can be lots of things. But it is a really interesting field because it's about people.
Yeah, and I think it's something that we're seeing right now really come to a head with, you know, a lot of the Silicon Valley companies started jumpstarting this of creating new and innovative workplaces. I know in my industry, which is the legal industry, at their big conference, they were rolling out new plans for what law offices might even look like, because we're seeing such a high increase in stress and unhappiness and a lack of balance between work and life and happiness and personal and professional, and it's all just kind of melding together. And does part of this have to do more with separating the two out, or what are some things that you would suggest to make your workplace less stressful?
Well, there are lots of good habits that we can have, as well as changes that we can make in the physical workplace. And one of the really easy ones to address, I think, or to throw out there, is this idea of bringing the outdoors in. So, you know, back in the day, a million years ago, we spent a lot of time on the savanna, you know, out and outside. And I was talking to some paleoanthropologists and others who really are looking at, you know, modern hunter-gatherer societies. I always think it's interesting to kind of go back and where do we come from and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And they were saying, well, that we used to actually spend eight or nine miles a day, often at a slow pace, and we were doing so with you know, every once in a while chasing an animal or whatever. But for the most part, just on the move for a large portion of our day, and also doing so in a really wide open space, like the home range, as they call it, was somewhere between, you know, 1 to 5 miles. So a pretty vast area is your workplace or your home place or both. So it's kind of interesting now, you know, fast forward, you know, millions of years, and here we are in these tiny cubicles, hunched, crunched over, Cro-Magnon style, as I like to call it, you know, overlooking at our laptops or computers, and not moving and not eating well, and just are eating at our desk, and just all these habits that are really counterintuitive to the way that we're constructed. And so there's this problem, this conflict that constantly comes up when that happens. And a lot of it has to do, it affects us physically. Obviously, the, you know, sitting is killing us. All the news are talking about that a lot, where, you know, there's this movement to get sit to stand desks or desktops that move up and down, you know, so you can stand, or encouraging people to move around their space a bit, take walking meetings and things like that. But that physical change, literally standing or moving, also helps our mental state. So there's the ability to move around. And then there's also bringing nature into our work environment. And there's this thing in the world of architecture. We are starting to refer to it now as biophilia, which is our preference as people to be in and among nature. It's very strong. And if you look at a lot of work environments, they're like completely sterile, right? It's a bunch of cubicles, or even the office is like white walls and, you know, kind of just boring. Maybe there's like a photo of a cat or something, whatever, but it's just not, you know, a little sad plant in the corner. But it's not nearly as interesting, as vibrant, you know, both from a, you know, visually and the sounds and smells, all those sorts of things that are in nature. And so I think that, you know, this idea of bringing in actual plants or even fake plants work really well. There have been all the studies that say, you know, people who are typing or doing some tasks that are, you know, easily measurable, they will take a break, encouraged to take a break and look at a fake plant, even for just a couple seconds, relaxes the lizard part of our brain, so that we're much more likely to get back on task. And I think, you know, you're starting to see green walls, live and fake, all are good. People using landscapes, or even things that they're called natural analogs, fancy term, but really it's things that kind of mimic nature. It's not really nature, but like a national airport, these big columns that kind of look like trees, or a screen that kind of looks like, oh, an ivy wall or whatever. Those sorts of things also count. And water features, all of those sorts of things really do impact how we feel. There's one little funny factoid, you can throw this out at parties, which is that physically, I mean, the surfaces that we look at in any space, it could be your home or work or wherever, but if those those surfaces are natural in material, like wood, a wood grain, not painted wood, but like an actual grain, or brick or something that looks more natural, if 43% or more of the surfaces are natural materials, they're more psychologically restorative.
What?
Which is kind of,
that's amazing.
Yeah. This is from my, you know, environmental psychologist friends who have done all kinds of lit reviews on it. But the idea is that, like the more that we can encourage our space to actually look like the natural environment, the better. And in fact, the more that you can get out into the environment, the better, in terms of like getting out in the morning and getting your sunshine and getting exposure to what's called, you know, circadian light waves, or they're waves from the sun that set your sleep cycle. It's really, really important. And so in buildings now, we're starting to see a lot of what's called circadian artificial lighting, which is mimicking these particular light waves, which trigger wakefulness or sleepiness. Anyway, there's so much to talk about.
Yeah, so many of us, I know, struggle with insomnia. And I remember years ago, I was working with one of the top brain scientists in the world because I actually struggled with it myself. And he taught me a really great trick because I travel a lot as well. And he said, when you travel, or just in general, if you're having trouble sleeping, what you want to do is you want to spend at least 1 hour in direct sunlight with no sunglasses or anything on between, I think it's the hours of 8 a.m. and 12 p.m. in whatever time zone you're in. And that will naturally facilitate the production of melatonin in your brain, which makes you fall asleep easier. And that's, he gave a great example. He said, notice that if you spend the day outdoors all day in the beach, you sleep like a rock that night. And it's because your brain has been busy telling your body all day, melatonin, melatonin, melatonin. So I'm sure it probably ties into that same principle, right?
Absolutely. And for those of us who can't be on the beach all day, if you say that, which I would love to do, especially this summer. But I'm thinking, or a lot of the sleep scientists I'm talking to these days are kind of suggesting an hour or two in the morning, whatever you can squeeze in, particularly the morning hours, because that is when the melatonin is really shutting off, flooding your brain and starting to build up for the following evening. So, I think it's great. And what's cool, so there's a lot of study that's been done on these artificial systems to mimic nature or this natural phenomenon. And most of them are, a lot of the research is happening in Denmark or, you know, in places where the lighting is not so good. There's seasonal affective disorder. And it's really, really pretty awesome what's starting to hit the world today. And you can even buy a light bulb now that's like a wake and alert bulb that you can put in your office.
I think I just lost you, Lee.
Oh, yeah. I'm so sorry. You here now?
Lee, I'm going to pause you for a second. Yeah, I can hear you now, but you were telling us some juicy little bit. You said something, something, and then you cut out like right at that moment where you were sharing the juicy.
Oh, I was probably smiling at my receiver or something. Sorry. No. It's, there's a light bulb that you can buy even for your house. You can buy it for your work, too. That's called the Awake and Alert Bulb. That's by Lighting Science, I believe. And then there's a Sleepy Time light bulb that you can put at your bedside or your kid's bedside, wherever you want to encourage sleep. Yeah, isn't that interesting? So this idea is, you know, that with a lot of the systems in workplaces and even homes now, the changing circadian light throughout the day, they're a little more expensive because they're pretty new. For those of us who are in one place all day, the idea is to take advantage of that changing light. We need the biorhythms. We need the change.
Yeah, that's great. And what have you, along the same lines, it's a huge push I've noticed for in law firms and corporations across the country and around the world for meditation. And people are being incentivized to meditate, or even you have mindfulness sessions at the workplace. Have you noticed that architecturally or from a structural standpoint that there's anything you can do to help facilitate a more peaceful meditative state if employers make that available to you?
Yes. Well, one of the most important things to do if you want to create a space, a time and place and all those sorts of things for meditation, is to create a place that feels safe, from disruption, safe from someone up sneaking up behind you, that you can fully concentrate on, you know, being mindful and letting go and all these sorts of things that are really, really important, paying attention to your breath and centering yourself. And I think sometimes we'll stick these spaces in strange little areas that are loud, or there are noises nearby, things like that. So the idea is if you can create a place, it could be dark. It's great if it has a view of nature. That's always a plus. But maybe it's just a landscape, you know, or something, or a little water feature that you can put in a tiny little closet. It does not have to be a large space, but just some place that you can truly concentrate and feel like you can let go of that stress that's, you know, balling itself up at the back of your neck kind of thing. I have seen some really interesting new designs at the company Headspace.
I believe. Oh, yes. I was just going to suggest them. Yeah, they do that great meditation app online that
they have an app. And if you Google their headquarters, using the verb, Google their headquarters space, And I guess it's in San Francisco. I've forgotten. But it has little pods that they've created for their employees that actually you put on these earphones and you can sit and meditate in these little pods. I thought that was cute. There's another cool little piece of furniture coming out called a Buddha booth, as in Buddha, which kind of looks cute and small, a little tiny box. That you have a little cushion and maybe some drapes to kind of allow you to kind of close yourself off if you need to. But I thought that was really clever. But, yeah, just things that it doesn't have to be, you know, anything special other than a little bit away from the traffic.
Yeah, it makes such a big difference. It was so funny. There was an old client of mine, an attorney who I've known for probably 15 years, called me the other day, and we hadn't talked in at least 5 or 6 years. And he said, Jennifer, what are you doing differently? You sound so peaceful and happy. And I remember when we used to talk, you always talked very quickly and seemed like you were in a rush to get somewhere. And I said to him, Toy, it's called meditation. I haven't missed a day in, you know, what has it been, 4 years now. And it makes such a difference. But you have to have that space and that, you know, place that you can go and just go within and be peaceful and have that stillness in the midst of a very busy day or week or month or whatever is going on. And taking that little bit of time out, it's only going to help you, help your employer. And something I know I've noticed too is my own staff knows if I get upset or frustrated, they're so cute. They'll tell me, they'll be like, Jay Hill, go for a walk. And it does. It makes a huge difference, like you said, to be out in nature. You know, even if you don't have nature in your office, most of us have parks or trees. And just even spending 5 or 10 minutes in the sun or going for a walk around the block can really calm down any sort of upset or anxiety you might be having.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, this being in a stress state is the least creative mode that our brains can be in. And there's a lot of science that shows that when we are at our most creative, when the alpha waves are jumping out of our upper right cortex or whatever they come from, which seems to be what the science is saying lately, where, you know, there's certain aspects of our brain that, you know, when turned on, we just come up with these awesome insights and solutions to all our problems. And what triggers that is when we're relaxed. And that can be walking, that can be in a shower, it can be in any number of places. The guy who invented Post-it notes was bored in church, you know, but he had a little moment of quiet and just not thinking about anything else, or just, again, you know, a place where he relaxed and felt at peace. And so I think any way that we can pull ourselves away from straining, you know, to come up with a solution, that's actually when it's least likely to come to us.
Yeah, and something I've been learning about recently, I just heard this in a class I was in on partnership and accountability, was brilliant. The woman leading the class said, do you realize that your brain, when you have an upset, you're in reaction mode, that your, I think it's the amygdala, you probably know the brain better than I do, or the back of our brain that's the emotional reactive state, that our executive brain or our prefrontal cortex is about 1 second behind the animalistic brain. And so if there's anything we can do to just pause and create balance, a meditative breath, or just having a peaceful environment, that's the difference between having World War III in your office and having a calm, collected, mature conversation with a colleague, a client, another person in your office, or whatever that might look like.
No, you're absolutely right. And it's there's all the studies are coming out showing that, you know, meditating for brand new meditators after, what is it, 8 weeks, they shrink their amygdala, they grow their executive function. Literally, you can change your brain. It is so exciting to see, you know, what that research is saying. The other thing I was thinking about when I first started researching the healthy workplace, I went to Miraval. And if any of your listeners have ever been there, it's pretty amazing. It's it's in Tucson, Arizona, and it's one of these places that really is testing the waters on, you know, mind-brain connection and crazy, go out and paint a horse, and just like very interesting stuff that they do out there. But I was like, oh, you know, I need to learn kind of what some of the latest things are. And one of the things my husband and I both tried was rock climbing, which we'd never done before. And we're not exactly, at the time anyway, in the best shape. And we're like, we're going to do this. Put on these fancy shoes. And both of us got about halfway up this wall, this little training wall that they had us working on. And we were just panicked. panic. Like, I'm holding on to a wall. And, like, I know there's a guy who's got a chain who's belaying me, you know. I'm safe. I kind of know this, but it doesn't matter because I'm still clinging to a wall, and I can't figure out which one of these stupid knobs I'm supposed to grab for next. If you've ever done rock climbing, you kind of know the, you know the feeling. And so the guy below was like, okay, this is a moment. Just take a big breath. You know, just look at the mountains. The Sonora Mountains are so beautiful. Check it out. You know, just think about what's so great about your life or whatever. And after literally maybe 10 seconds, 15, I was like, oh, I'll just grab that knob. And boom, 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 made my way up to the top. And the same with my husband. We were like, oh, such a good teaching moment. Where here we are, you know, when I get stressed at work, same deal, right? You just, you can't find your way out of a solution, and you get so frustrated, and I'm just going to quit. And all these things were physically running through my body for sure, you know, shaking on that wall, and then taking the big, deep breaths. That's all I needed, you know, to kind of keep going. And anyway, I think a lot of, interestingly, a lot of universities are looking at rock climbing as kind of a mind-brain, how to help kids deal with stress, or, you know, young adults deal with stress, which I thought was really very clever.
Yeah, it's so important, too, and you don't even realize young kids. I was fortunate enough to be honored at an SOS Mentor event last week as a philanthropist, and it wasn't, it was great. I mean, I've done a lot of work with the charity, and I'm more of like the fundraiser than the person who goes out and mentors, but oh my gosh, Lee, some of these kids, there were three kids who shared who came from very low-income households. One kid was homeless part of the time, and to hear the difference that it made to have kids who mentored them on how to eat healthier, how to make healthier choices. One kid even said it saved his life, and I was bawling like a baby. I'm not gonna lie. I was like, oh my gosh, you know, some of these kids have never even tasted an apple before or a peach because all they had was the local liquor store food. And I know that's something that you were saying is important too, is nutrition. Is we undervalue not only the mental side and the physical exercise, whether it's rock climbing or the meditation or yoga, but at the same time, it's the nutritional aspect. I've noticed for myself, I'll buy my office these snack packs sometimes. And you think it's like a gourmet snack pack, but all that's in there is all these processed foods. And then I feel like crap. My office feels like crap. And yet if you have fresh apples or tangerines or different things that are more nutritionally valuable, it you feel better all day and you're able to work more effectively. Have you noticed that at all in your research for the healthy workplace?
Oh, yes, no doubt. One of the best resources I found was the Human Performance Institute. I don't know if you've heard of that, but maybe your listeners have. Effectively, it's a it's where it's in Orlando, and it's where elite athletes go to improve their game, and have been going there for 30 years. It was started by Lair and Gropel, a couple of guys who sports psychologists slash physiologist types who helped, you know, Pete Sampras name a tennis player. They work with them and really. And, you know, soccer, hockey and a whole bunch of stuff. And basically they said they could tell, or they could work with these athletes and get them from their A game to an A-plus world-class game by helping them manage their energy. That was the difference between the good and the great players. And so what they did was that they went crazy down to the microbial level at looking at managing exercise and training and all the usual sleep and all the things we've discussed just now, but also really looking at nutrition. And one of the things that they found was this need for us to eat three regular size meals, but not too big, and then snack. The snacking is really important if you want to maintain a consistent, you know, or your glycemic index and, you know, maintain those, or minimize those spikes, lack of sugar and all the things that we need during the course of a day, and minimize those by eating a snack in between meals every 2 to 4 hours, between 100 and 150 calories. It gets very prescriptive very quickly. But it was very helpful. So they're like, no, you need to be hungry before a meal, so don't gorge on your snack, but have them and be available. And, you know, I found that, honestly, a good offense is the best defense. If you're hungry, you're going to eat something. You know, it's going to be that donut. It's going to be that snack popcorn or whatever, you know, is available in the pantry or in your refrigerator unless you prepare. And you really do have to have some fresh fruits, veggies, yogurt, you know, hummus or something that's available to you and it's got a little protein in it, especially is great, of course. And it helps manage between meals. And that is the real difference. That keeps you going at 100% all day. And their whole thing, and I think this is so great, it's like, you know what, you should have as much energy when you go home at night after a big work day that you brought with you to work. You know, we should be able to not just give our best hours to our job, but give even more great hours to our friends and our family and everybody we come home to at night or, you know, after work. I think that's just an important way of thinking about it, because it's the work-life thing, but it's all part of the same story, and you need a really happy personal life to be fulfilled in other ways in your career. It just, you know, we need it all. We have to be mindful of that. And I really appreciate, you know, this little coaching on nutrition goes a long way to really help me anyway think about what I want to give to my day and to my week and to all the people that are in my life.
Yeah, it's taking that moment too, going from, I think, the amygdala, the animalistic brain. I'm hungry. I must eat something now. I was totally there earlier. You've calmed me down. I will no longer call the CEO of DoorDash, because we did a birthday party for one of my staff today and we ordered from DoorDash and everybody's food arrived and we had cake for later, but one of the people's meals didn't arrive. So I gave my meal to the person whose meal didn't arrive. And God forbid, I eat like clockwork. Like every 2 hours, I have my snack and I eat my lunch normally by 11:30. And today it was at probably, I think, 1 or 1:30 when we figured out lunch was not being delivered the way it was meant to be delivered. And I went into my animal brain. I was just ready to kill somebody, you know, starving to death. And all I wanted to do was snack on something. And I looked around the office and all there was cookies and this cake and other things. And you don't realize how hard it is to make healthy choices. I feel like so much junk food is readily available, whether it's chocolates or candies or, you know, just chips that are sitting around. But today I started a cleanse where I'm doing no sugar, no gluten, and what was the other thing I was doing? Oh, no dairy, which really limits your options. So I basically starved for about 2 hours because I was not willing to break this detox that I was doing. And it really brings awareness, though, for you to go, wow, there's just not a lot of healthy options available in offices. How many of us do have fresh fruits or raisins or something that could have a sustainable impact if we're really hungry? And I could really see where that has a negative impact. You look at so many corporations and law firms that have sodas, you know, they have lots of sodas. And in this SOS Mentor event I was at last week, they were saying that they show children, and there's an exhibit, I guess, going around right now that's viral, that shows kids how one can of soda, a Coca-Cola, has like, I think it's 10 tablespoons of sugar in it. And when you start to realize that and the cost and impact of what that sort of stuff has on our body, like you said, by the time we get home to our significant others, our family, whoever it might be, even if it's just a cat or a dog, we're spent and we have nothing left to give because we've expanded or what's what I'm looking for. We've wasted all of that energy all day by not feeding our body with the right fuel.
Yeah. I mean, the good news is there are some tricks. There's some tricks.
Tricks.
The trade.
Give us some tricks. What are some additional tricks?
So sure one of the big buzzwords that's going around lately is this idea of choice architecture. And so the concept of choice architecture is food producers or merchandisers know a lot about it. Like in grocery stores, basically the food that has the most to promote or it costs them the most to display is actually the end of the aisles, which is where you spend most of the time. Most people actually, if you're not my husband, who goes through every single aisle. But most
mine
of us
too.
So annoying. There could be something I forgot. Anyway, yes. So, but most of us just kind of skim the outside, peek in, and so what's in the middle of the line, the aisle is actually the least expensive for them to store or, you know, to put it in the grocery store. And the most expensive stuff is at the checkout counter and at the end of the aisle. And so they know that, and they're placing all their best products there, so we grab them. And a lot of companies are realizing this kind of mentality and are changing the cafeteria so that healthy food is at the checkout counter, you know, for employees. It's yogurt and healthy bars and fruit as opposed to all the unhealthy stuff, which is available, but maybe it's a little bit hidden. The other thing is there's kind of the training of the cafeteria staff. So when you go up and say, I'd like to get the chicken, instead of saying, would you like fries with that? They say, would you like a salad with that? That's the first thing they offer, which you're much more likely to, oh, yeah, salad. Yes, of course. That's a great idea. You know, so we need these prompts. We need visual prompts and we need verbal to change our behavior. And I've noticed a lot of organizations actually have glass fridges now in their cafe / dining area, whatever, because a lot of food that's actually healthy for you has a short shelf life. It needs to be refrigerated, like eggs or tuna or milk or whatever. And the processed stuff can be thrown in a bag and left out on the counter. So to the extent that you can remind people and or yourself that your healthy lunches in there are healthy options, that is a really great idea. And at home, you can try this trick by putting things that are healthy in a glass bowl and things that are not so healthy in a translucent or opaque bowl. And just see how quickly the healthy food gets snatched up versus the non-healthy.
That's a great idea, because I don't know about your husband, but mine, it's like if it's in a colored bowl or something he can't see through, the same leftovers will sit in the fridge for a week, whether they're healthy or unhealthy. He just doesn't see it. But I'm sure that's true of all of us as human beings. If we open the fridge and see a clear bag or a clear bowl, we're going to be much more likely to grab for that rather than something that we can't see.
Yeah, like the clear glass Tupperware. Glass is pretty easy to see through. Like if you're storing carrots or celery, or you know, you want to put that front and center in the fridge and on a low shelf for small hands, if you have those in your house. And definitely, something you can see through really, really easily. There's also all kinds of cool tricks you can play about plate size. So big plates are actually, you know, over like 12 inches or so. They look great, you know, nice chargers or whatever. But if you actually fill your plate full of food, you're putting a lot of food on the plate. And if you get a plate that's too small, like 6 inches or so, it feels like, oh, that's like a side plate. You always feel like you want 2 or 3 servings of that. So the best plate size is like an 8-inch plate. That's kind of like the perfect portion size, and it has a little rim, and then there's, you know, maybe 7 inches or so diameter of food, and that's like, you know, 3 fistfuls. That's like good. That's going to fill you up, 3 to 5 fistfuls. And then also there's science that says that if the plate is a color versus white, like a lot of us love our white china, but if you have a plate that's a color, all those starches that we're obsessed with, like pasta and whatever, they don't show up on a white plate. So you typically pile more on than if on a colored plate, where it actually looks like it's a lot less, or looks like it's a lot more, you know, a trick of the eye kind of thing. But you're much more likely to serve yourself less of potatoes, of, you know, all those white foods. So kind of interesting little trick, little fun trivia.
One of my other favorite tricks too, because for me, sometimes I'm always just here and there and I'm never home. And I find that I would buy vegetables or fruits and they would wilt or they would go bad. And I remember somebody taught me a couple years ago, 2 tricks. One is with cucumbers, which are a great healthy snack. You can get those little Persian cucumbers from Trader Joe's. And the trick to make them last longer is you put them in a Ziploc baggie, or like you said, a clear bowl, but with a paper towel to absorb the water. And for me, I found that instead of lasting 3 days and I would be back and then they'd be rotten, it would last me 2 to 3 weeks that way. And then you still have your fresh veggies longer. And the same thing goes for strawberries. You cut the tops off of them and put them in a bowl or something with like a paper towel to absorb some of the moisture. And then you're more likely to buy more of it if you're the one doing the shopping for the house, if you know it's going to last longer and not just get thrown away.
That's great.
Yeah,
I also like it in a little baggie that's perfectly proportioned, like nuts or strawberries or anything like that. I think, yeah, the portion control. We could all use a little help with that, too.
Yeah, little things like that, but we're just so accustomed to grabbing for the first sugary quick fix thing. In fact, somebody told me in a class a couple weeks ago, she said, do you want to know why if you're eating mac and cheese, there never seems to be enough? Well, our brain goes because it's the most delicious thing ever. But what she actually said is the reason that you will continuously eat more and more mac and cheese is because your body is trying to find some sort of nutritional value where it doesn't exist. However, for example, she gave Indian food and she said, if you're eating Indian food, you'll notice you get full after only a couple bites. And it's because of all the natural antibiotics, antihistamines, all the things that come from turmeric and cumin and the great spices that are in there, where your body gets filled up 10 times faster than if you were eating, say, mac and cheese. That was something really interesting that I only recently learned about.
So we'll just from now on be spreading cumin on our mac and cheese.
We'll skip the mac and cheese, but I don't think any of us could do that because I'm definitely a mac and cheese fan as well. So
right.
one other another question for you about this, because we're going through a lot of ideas and a lot of tips, you know, things from adding, you know, more natural looks to your environment, plants, those sorts of things, different food choices. Is this something that an employee can take the helm of and could be responsible for, or does it always have to be the onus of the employer? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the responsibility lies in all of us, in managers, because they really set, in all sorts of managers, not just, you know, the chief Pumbaa, but all of us who manage others are an influence over them. And so the behaviors that we have, others watch like hawks and are making sure that, you know, they're following our lead. And I think the more that we can demonstrate good, healthy behaviors, the more likely our staff are to adopt them. And I think that's just really, really key. Culture is just so strong in our organizations. And this whole sending your staff emails at, you know, midnight is not cool. It's not. I'll just go out there and say it. hold off. Wait till the morning. You know, give it some time. And you shouldn't be checking your email, and neither should your staff, after a certain amount of time. And so making up rules with them, you know, or just starting to model behavior on your own to try things out and see how you feel and see how productive you are. Use yourself as a test subject, I think, is great. And I think that all of us can adopt a lot of these strategies without having to ask permission of a boss or anything. Certainly bringing, you know, a fake plant in or putting in a beautiful landscape on your screensaver, or taking a few minutes away from your desk and meditating, or going outside for a little bit. I think it is possible to do that, and sometimes you have to do it little steps at a time, and explain to, you know, your colleagues what's going on. Like, I'm not going to be at my desk. I'm just going to go do, you know, a little meditation. It's going to make me more productive. Trust me, kind of thing. It is really important, I think, to try these things. And, you know, these are behavior changes. You can't change everything at once. It's really tough to do, but just pick one or two things and change the behaviors. And sure enough, you'll find that it's easy. It's not nearly as hard, and you aren't given nearly as hard a time as you thought you would be. I know a lot of people, you know, are just like, my boss won't let me do that, or I feel really uncomfortable standing up while working, for example, or taking a conference call while walking, or whatever the case may be. But just do it once. Just try a couple things here and there and test it out. And make sure that it, you know, it's supportive of the way that you work. It isn't, you know, like causing you to be unproductive. But a lot of these things really do help productivity. And so one of the ways that I really started adopting things for real and not just testing was by measuring myself. So one thing I noticed, I was spending a month or so first writing this book, not at my day job. I took a sabbatical. And all I was doing was writing, like, hardcore all day, and researching and calling people. And I found, God, you know, like, I am giving my brain everything I can, and I can only honestly work for 7 hours. That is as much as I can write. I'm sure there are people who can write a lot longer, but I'm doing this for months and months at a time, and I can't, you know, sustain this more than, you know, 6 or 7 good hours a day. And I would even take big breaks in there. I was like, okay, I'd write for an hour and a half and then leave. And sometimes I'd, you know, get some flow on and write for maybe 3 hours and then leave, take a quick walk and then, or go get lunch or whatever and come back. And I felt that was a really good experiment on myself, you know, just to kind of, okay, this is, I'm not going to pass judgments on anybody else, just see how I work. And it really helped me define how I'm most productive and what I need to be the most effective as a thought leader. And when I went back to work, I negotiated a 30-hour week and not a 40-hour week, and I took a pay cut. It was rough. I mean, my husband and I kind of went through and like, oh, can we do this? But I was like, you know what? I'm going to be so much happier and so much more productive, and I've got 2 little kids. I've got a life to manage as well, and I want to do some writing on the side, and I just can't get it all done and give my best self to my job or my family if I'm working 60, 78 hours a week like I was doing before. So it's, you know, again, it's different for everybody in every situation. But I do think kind of measuring aspects of your life, and you know, you were talking about how meditating before and you felt very relaxed and your team noticed it, that's a measure. And so things like that are really useful.
Yeah, that's a great idea. It's because if it doesn't, my business coach always says, if you don't measure it, it doesn't exist. And so if you're not actively pursuing or keeping track of how often you're meditating, going for a walk, even like you said, those little 15-minute breaks. In California, I don't know what the labor laws are in the other states around the country or around the world, but I know that you're mandated to take 2 15-minute breaks if you're a non-exempt employee, which means that you're paid overtime plus a minimum of a half-hour lunch. And so many people don't even utilize that extra half hour a day where they could be going for a 15-minute walk. They could be doing a 15-minute meditation. There are so many great things that you could do and utilize that time. And what you just said was really interesting. You said, well, I would work about an hour and a half and then I would take a little break or go for a walk. And I do remember a couple of years ago, I'd read an article, something around brain science, saying that we're most productive if we take a break every 90 minutes. It doesn't have to be a full 10-minute, 30-minute break, but our brains are only equipped to really focus on something in 90-minute increments. And so often, we just push ourselves through because we think we'll be a better employee or a better person if we work longer, harder, faster, et cetera. And we don't realize it's actually detrimental to our productivity if we're not taking that moment out to balance that time and to give our brain that space to be able to process and, like you said earlier, choose.
Yeah, I think there's a, I was just talking with a reporter from the Wall Street Journal a couple of days ago about visual distractions, and there's also acoustical distractions, and, you know, a lot of times I think we're so distracted at work, you know, little pop-up screens or somebody stopping by, there are a lot of things that get, prevent us from getting our flow on, you know, getting our work done, and that gets in the way, or that disruption visually or acoustically or whatever prevents us from being as productive as we'd like to be, and so we feel guilty taking additional breaks. It feels like, wait, hold on, you know, like, yeah. I barely get through my real work today because I was, you know, so reacting to email or whatever the case may be. And I think, you know, the visual distraction part, reducing things that move, you know, back to the savannah where we spent most of history, things, an animal that moved was typically something that definitely took our attention, right? We wanted to capture that animal and eat it. It was very, very important. An animal coming after us. And so we are just primordially attuned to noises that sound weird or people or things that sound weird. And that includes pop-up screens or you've got mail or other things that that pop up on our work surface or what we're working on. So I think it's kind of a multi-pronged approach. You know, we need to take breaks. We also need to manage that hour and a half really well so that we're uber productive during that time and can kind of get into a subject deeply without a lot of distraction. It's really hard, and we are really addicted to our devices, and Facebook is betting all kinds of money on it, you know, that they are going to get advertising dollars for every interruption. They, oh, you like this friend's doing this? Well, did you see what this other friend is doing? Oh my gosh, you know, it's just so easy to get sucked into the vortex. And so, you know, we've got to turn it off, and we've got to use tools that allow us to collaborate in a way that is on our own time, you know, isn't pushed to us. But we go to, there's a guy I was talking to recently who literally gave up email. His entire team gave up email. He's like, I just get copied on everything. It's annoying. I don't need to know all this information. And they started adopting project management tools, and Asana, I think was the name of it, and Slack, and some of these other tools that allowed the team to go in and work and notify other people. But it wasn't pushing alerts to them like email does constantly to the rest of us. And I thought, oh, that's really interesting. So he's finding, you know, obviously we all work electronically now, a good number of us. But the ways that, you know, the tools that we're using could be different such that it really reduces our stress and allows us to, in our own time, manage those chunks as we have them through the day.
brilliant. I think you've had so many tips, Lee. I mean, you and I could spend another 2 to 3 hours discussing this. To all of our listeners, please go out, buy Lee's book, The Healthy Workplace, by Lee Stringer, L-E-I-G-H-S-T-R-I-N-G-E-R. Lee, if they want to find out more information or they wanted to look you up or where they could find the book, where would they do that?
Well, they can find the book on Amazon or anywhere books are sold. And if you want to follow some of the research that I'm finding, and there's new research like minute by minute, go to leestringer.com, and I'm sharing it and trying to link to all the great information that's available and filter it just as I can. I think in this whole health and wellness craze, there's a lot of I don't know what the term is, but a lot of false information. And so I try and leverage my smart network to validate some of the stuff that comes through. But you can find me there.
That's great, Lee. Well, you've given so many great tips. Just to recap some of the things you suggested, spend more time in the sun. There were some great light bulbs. Can you give me those again? Because I even want to write those down personally. Those were great. What were the light bulbs?
So the bulb that I have is from Lighting Science, but I believe that GE and Philips also make circadian light bulbs. But the one for the daytime work is called Awake and Alert, and then there's a sleepy time one for nighttime.
Ah, awesome. I'm totally Googling it right now as we speak. I think it's
awesome.
Brilliant that there's so many great things like that you suggested, you know, getting outdoors, utilizing nature in the workplace, utilizing better nutrition. You've given our listeners a wealth of tips. It's been such a pleasure to have you on the show. And again, if you miss the show at any time, you can always find it on iTunes under Get Yourself the Job on iTunes. Or if you have any feedback or questions or guests that you would love us to have on the show, you can always go to Facebook, speaking of Facebook, /Get Yourself the Job and comment on your thoughts on the show or pose questions that we are happy to ask on air with our guests. So thank you so much, Lee, and I hope all of our listeners have an incredible week.
Thank you. This was a pleasure.
All right. Take care.
You're listening to Get Yourself the Job with Jennifer Hill, only on LA Talk Radio.